Well, good morning. Lacey found this silver necklace on the ground. Anybody? Anybody's? Didn't fit around my neck or else I'd wear it. I guess nobody. I'll sell it to the pawn shop then. Thank you. If you realize it's yours or you like, oh yeah, I am missing that, then come talk to me afterwards and I might arrange a trade. So we have been looking for the last 9 weeks at the book of Amos. Amos is a very challenging book in the Old Testament, and Amos speaks to people who are extremely wealthy because some land has just gone out, trade routes are now in their country that weren't there before, and so money just pours into this nation. And Amos critiques church people, which is kind of surprising. He critiques them not because they're not showing up to church on time or not doing the right sacrifices, but because they have all of this wealth, and they're not using it for the good of God's glory. They're not using it to use it as a blessing to other people. In fact, they're using it, as Amos continues to remind them, to oppress people who are in need. And so the question after you kind of go through the book of Amos is, okay, if I am wealthy, I mean, we're going to kind of look at what the definition of wealthy is over the next few weeks in this series. The question is, if I'm wealthy, then how do I be wealthy well? Like, how do I use what God has given me well? So we're going to be doing this series for the next 4 weeks called Good Wealth, where we look at and kind of understand what it means to be wealthy well. Because Amos kind of challenged us to think about that. We're going to continue to think about that over these next few weeks with just some specific things, some biblical principles that help us to understand how to use what God has given us to God's glory. When we think typically about like the forces of good and evil, we think of it in a pretty simplistic way. And I think of this picture of Homer Simpson, who is struggling with evil on one side and angel on the other. And almost all TV shows do this. I was Googling for one with Steve Urkel, but I couldn't find it. I do weird Google searches for these sermon series, trying to find some pictures, because I remembered that one, but I couldn't find it. This was the best one that I could find, but almost all TV shows will tell you that it's something like that, right? Or movies where it's like there's the devil on one side and there's the angel on the other. I have a friend who's like the nicest person in the world, and my friend and I joke with her that she has the devil on her shoulder, but hers doesn't really say bad things to do. Hers is like, yeah, you can do it. Go to bed without brushing your teeth. Yeah, you could be bad, or just roll through that stop sign. Come on. I mean, but some of us have a little more evil thoughts here and there telling us to do more evil things. But we usually think of it in these terms, right? You know, you have kind of like the evil force on one side and the good force on the other. But Jesus, when he's speaking, he's going to speak about worry. The sermon series that we did on worry a few months ago, he talks kind of about what the forces are that are at play. And he says this. Go ahead to the next slide. No one can serve two masters. Either you will hate the one and love the other, or you'll be devoted to the one and despise the other. You cannot serve both God and money. It seems kind of like a weird thing to put in there, right? I mean, wouldn't you think it's like devil on your shoulder, angel on the other? Like, you cannot serve both God and Satan? I mean, isn't that, if you were to do that, that would be how you filled it in, like angel versus demon? But Jesus says it's God versus money? Really? And the term that Jesus uses there can be kind of more defined and understood as stuff. But really? Like, stuff? Like that? That's that big of a deal to you? Like Jesus says, warning, 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 be careful about how you serve your money and your stuff. It's not like an angel on one side and a devil on the other. How are we supposed to understand this? What does this mean? I saw a New York Times article about people who had won the lottery. And they went and interviewed these people, and a few of them kind of were doing well. They had adjusted to this new lifestyle, but many of them, a very, very large percentage, reported that they had fallen into debt somehow, like they'd used so much that they'd fallen into debt. And then secondly, they reported that they had worse relationships because everyone comes out of the woodwork and is like, I'm your long-lost cousin. You had no idea, but I'm here. Everyone comes out of the woodwork because suddenly you're a millionaire. And so this article reports that they had worse relationships, and some people even miraculously fell into debt. And some of these people were saying, I wish it wouldn't have happened to me. I wish I didn't win the lottery. And there were comments at the bottom of this article. It was really funny. People, instead of commenting really on the nature of the article, they just started commenting about what they would do if they won the lottery. One person said that they'd end war in the world, which I don't think there's a check big enough for that, but I guess you could try. Another person said that they wanted to get a real live T-Rex skeleton to have in their house. Just, I guess that's kind of random. And another person said, this is probably my favorite, he would get a glossy picture of himself in a tub filled with money. And if anyone asks for money, he would send them that picture. And say, here's a picture of me with all the money, but not actually give them anything. So this article reports that even though they get all of these millions of dollars, people say that they end up, some people, in debt and almost consistently in worse relationships. Because even if you say no to somebody, or if you say no and you protect your money, you're kind of hurting a relationship. So who would still want to win the lottery, though? Raise your hand. Anybody? Yeah, a lot of people still are like, I'm cool with it. I'm fine with it. That's cool. Because you know what your assumption is? And it's the same assumption that I have is, yeah, that might be that jerk there that doesn't understand how to use money, but I would be different, right? I would, God, if you let me do this, like I will give a large percentage of it to you. I'll give it to the church. I'll do whatever it is. Your assumption is I would be different. And Jesus would say, I don't know that I'd be so sure about that. Because he says your struggle is not necessarily God on one side, angel on the other. Your struggle is with God and stuff or money. So that should be like a red flag to us. And so you want to say, Jesus, well, how do we do this well? If we are wealthy people, how do we do this well? How do we live well? We're going to look at this passage together. This will be kind of the cornerstone passage of this series, 1 Timothy 6, 17 and 18. And Paul is writing with instructions to Timothy, and he says, I want to give you these specific instructions for people who are rich. And again, this is something that we should really consider then. If Paul's writing and says, I want you to really think about the rich people, you need to hear this message. As people who live in America in 2013, we need to hear what this says. Command those who are rich in this present world not to be arrogant, nor to put their hope in wealth, which is so uncertain, but to put their hope in God, who richly provides us with everything for our enjoyment. Command them to do good, to be rich in good deeds, and to be generous and willing to share. See, Paul's hope for these early Christians as he writes to them, and his hope for us as well, is that if we are wealthy, that we would be wealthy well. That we would be good, we would be rich in good deeds, rich in generosity, willing to share. The thing is, the fact is, generally, wealthy people aren't as generous as maybe they should be. In fact, in America, there's a stat that says the more that people make, the less percentage-wise they give. If your household income is $50,000, according to tax records, you give 6% to charity. If your household income is $200,000 or above, generally people give 4% to charity. And obviously, it's more money when it's from the $200,000. Like, it's a little bit more in terms of actual dollars and cents. But as people get more wealthy, they generally give less to charity. And this should be a little bit surprising, right? Because you'd think once you get to that point and you have this margin, you have this ability to kind of live a little bit more of a luxurious lifestyle, then you'd think that you would give maybe a little bit more. But in fact, the opposite is true. I know that there are people in here, there are some young couples in here. There are people who, like Franny and Leslie, just about to get married. There are some people who are single, some people who are older. And some of you currently are at this 200,000 number. Someday, maybe you'll be there in 10 years or something down the road. And so my hope for you is that you would be wealthy well, that you would learn some of these principles that we're going to talk about over these next few weeks, and that you would learn to be wealthy well. Because this is what Paul is getting at in this passage to Timothy. That you would not be rich by hoarding what you have, but that you would be generous, that you would be rich, not in the world standards, but rich in good deeds. I think Paul reveals something that he knows is going to happen, that people who are wealthy often hold on to it instead of being willing to give it away. And why is it that this matters so much? I mean, why would I talk about money? You know, it's kind of awkward to talk about sometimes. But the reason that I do it is it's important because Jesus talks about it. Because it's one of the consistent themes in Scripture that you need to be considerate of what you have and how you can use that to bless others. And I would want people who work with you, your neighbors or your coworkers, to know something about you before they know that you're a Christian. And obviously, you want to maybe have that conversation someday with someone who's not a Christian, that you want to talk to them and share about your faith. But the thing that I would want them to know about you before they know that you're a Christian is that you're generous. I would want them to know that you're generous before they even know that you're a Christian. I would like them to form their opinion about you around your generosity and not your theology. And here's why that is. Because if you're having a conversation with someone and you bring up Jesus Christ and you bring up that you go to church, they're going to have one of three responses. Here's A, B, and C of the responses that they're going to have. A, they believe also, or they're somewhat interested maybe, and they're like, hey, I want to come to church with you. But really, like, that doesn't happen all that often, right? You're like, you reveal it, and generally people aren't like, what time is your service so I can write it down and be there with you? Generally, that doesn't happen. Sometimes it does. Sometimes they say, yeah, I go to church. Like, I go to church here, and you guys, that's great. You guys can high five and say, all right, we'll meet up in heaven. Like, we'll talk when we get there. Then B, they don't really believe, but they're not that hostile. Like, they're just like, okay, kind of indifferent. Maybe they want to change the subject. They continue to talk to you, but you can tell that they don't really want to engage you in that conversation too much. Then C, they don't believe, but they are hostile. I mean, it's like they just want to like hit an eject button and get out of there as soon as possible. Maybe they've had a bad experience in church, or maybe they have just a negative view of Christianity. And so when you say the word Christian or Christ, they seriously look like they just want to jump out a window right there, hide in a closet. I have that experience because being a preacher, I'll say that I work at a church, and people will be like, oh man, and they just start calling me father, and they start to think in the back of their mind, like, well, did I say a curse word in this conversation? No, I don't think so. But you see sometimes some of these reactions, people are like really scared. They want to run the other direction. So I know what it's like. I know what it's like when you say something, and people generally are going to have one of these three responses. Some people aren't really going to be that hostile, but some people are. And here's why it's important for those people, especially the B's and C's of that conversation, because those are the people that we should really care about, that we should be trying to reach out to. Like, the way that you're going to break down somebody who's a B and C, someone who's indifferent or someone who's hostile, I think is much more easily done. It's much more easily done through generosity than it is through beliefs. You can tell them all day that you believe in Jesus Christ and you can quote scripture to them, but it doesn't really make a connection with them. But what can is generosity. The way that you talk about how you serve, the things that you say, the organizations that maybe you give to, the things that you volunteer with, and you're able to bring up those in conversation. And that person might go, you know, I don't even know what he or she believes. I'm not even sure what he or she believes. He's generous, and I want to know why. She is very giving, and I want to know why. If you start with playing the Jesus card first, it may not end that well, but if you start with generosity, generosity makes us hard to resist. And nobody likes a stingy person. Mandy was just telling me a story about one of her coworkers, a story from a while ago. And it was when a couple of her coworkers who still work together met, and they had a huge dinner party. And at the end of the dinner party comes the awkward point where the check comes, and there's like 10 or 15 credit cards, and some people have cash, and it usually takes about 45 minutes to sort the whole thing out as you pass it around the table. And this one guy who was like pretty good with numbers, he got frustrated because it came back to him and it was $4 short. Like, they were so close, but $4 short. And so he was like, usually you just kind of let that pass and you throw in the extra for yourself or whatever, but he wasn't going to let that happen this time. He's like, someone shorted this and I want to find out who. So he went around to every person and said, how much did you owe, and how much did you give? And he went around to every single person And he came to the one at the end, the last guy, and he said, "How much did you owe?" And he said, 11. And he said, "How much did you give?" He said, 7. And he said, "Why?" He said, "Well, there was some coleslaw on my plate, but I didn't eat that. So I guess I just thought I didn't have to pay." And nobody likes a stingy person, right? Nobody wants to be the one who's like, "Well, I didn't eat any of the coleslaw, so I'm not going to pay for that." Nobody likes a stingy person. In fact, nobody even likes the one who is $4 short and then goes around and looks at everybody. Nobody likes that guy either. And nobody likes someone who's not generous. What if generosity could be the most striking feature of us in our neighborhoods and at work? And this is the kind of no-strings-attached love that early Christians were known for. And they were known as being people who were risky givers, who were risky in their generosity, risky in the ways that they showed love. Jesus says in Luke chapter 6, verse 33, "If you do good to those who are good to you, what credit is that to you? Even sinners do that. And if you lend to those from whom you expect repayment, what credit is that to you? Even sinners lend to sinners expecting to be repaid in full. But love your enemies, do good to them, and lend to them without expecting to get anything back. Then your reward will be great, and you will be children of the Most High, because He is kind to the ungrateful and the wicked." So Jesus says in this powerful passage, don't just do good to those who can pay you back. Don't just do good to the people who are able to write you a check and you give them $20 and they can give you $20 back. Don't just do good to them. Be generous to people who are even evil to you. Be generous to people who aren't going to be able to ever pay you back. Because this is how people will know that you're a follower of mine. This is how they will know that you're different than the rest of the world. And Jesus speaks this into this culture that was very much a I'll pay you, you pay me back society. There was a term called liberalitas in Roman society. And this was this understanding that you would give to somebody, but the expectation was, I'll give this to you, but later you owe me. Like, I'll let you borrow my lawnmower, but later you owe me. I mean, I'll give you this for a little while, but later you owe me. There's a story of the Emperor Trajan who was going through one of the major cities in Rome, and he was going through, and this is in 99 AD, and he was throwing coins out to the populace and saying this term, liberalitas, to the people. And it was written actually on the coins in Rome. Liberalitas is the coin, is what was printed on these coins. And so there's this understanding that I'll do something for you, you're going to pay me back. It may not be the exact same thing, but you scratch my back and I'll scratch yours. So that's kind of the understanding that develops. And Jesus, speaking into this culture that very much has this understanding, says, no, if you're going to be followers of mine, you're going to be different than that. You're going to practice generosity that isn't going to make sense to people. You're going to show generosity to people who are evil. You're going to show generosity to people who people just wouldn't expect you to show generosity to, because that is what a follower of mine looks like. And so a term started to develop around the Christian way of giving, which is charitas, which is where we get our term charity from. And historians, as they wrote about these early Christians, they were extremely confused because they would keep doing things that didn't make sense from outsiders' perspectives. Like, there were plagues around that time, and instead of leaving the cities like everyone else, Christians intentionally went into the cities where plagues would happen, and historians would write things like, it doesn't make any sense. It's like these people aren't afraid to die. And what was it that got the Christian faith out of the first few centuries? Because there's so many other faiths and belief systems who over time have just perished and fallen away. It's this type of giving that day after day Christians would live out. There's a wonderful story of a guy who became a saint, Saint Pacomius. He was in Egypt, and he had been captured by Rome, and they were going to train him and some of the people that they had captured to be in their army. And so he is in prison and waiting to go join the army. And so as they're in prison, as they're waiting on this, strangers would show up every day to prison and bring them food twice a day. They would bring it to him and they would give it to him through the bars. And this guy is like, what is the deal with these people? Who are they? Why are they doing this? And he begins to talk with them a little bit and talk with some of the other prisoners. And he finds out that they're Christians. And they're doing this because of Jesus Christ. He's risen from the dead. And this is 300 years after Jesus has died. And he starts to ask questions and he thinks, you know, once I get out of prison, I'm going to explore this group more because they have been so generous to me. So he does. And he eventually became a Christian. And he founded monasteries all over the place. He founded like groups of monks who lived outside the city and tried to live the way of Jesus. I found a quote about his life that said this about St. Pacomius. From his initial monastery, demand quickly grew. By the date of his death in 345, there were 8 monasteries and several hundred monks. Within a generation after his death, this number grew to 7,000, then spread from Egypt to Palestine and the Judean desert, Syria, North Africa, and eventually Western Europe. All because some people brought some food to some prisoners. And this is the power of Christian generosity. That the generosity of a few changed the lives of thousands for generations. And again, as you look into the early development of the Christian faith, you just want to ask, how did this thing ever get out of the first century? You have a failed ruler who people aren't sure he rose from the dead. As James said earlier, how do you possibly believe that? That someone rose from the dead? And how do you believe that? But the people who carried out this faith, they believed it fully. And it not only was just a belief for them, it transported into their lives. And they became extremely generous in how they served, in how they loved, in how they showed God's love to the world. And I would say it's the primary reason that Christianity got through the first centuries. As persecution was happening, people continued to be generous. As people questioned it and didn't believe it, people continued to be generous. The generosity of Christianity is what makes us hard to resist. What if we were meant to be that way? I know something that's true about you. Whenever you see some of those videos or things about kids in poverty or places in third world countries, or when you see pictures of places after natural disasters happen, I know that your heart goes out for those people, right? And you see or hear about those situations and you feel a certain way and you probably cry and you think, man, this is just a terrible situation. But it's easy to just walk away from some of those things and feel sorry, but not really do anything. And the fact is, there's so much in our world that our heart goes out for, right? There's so much in our world that would make us cry, would make us sad, would make us upset. There's so much that's almost overwhelming. But here's my challenge for you, that you would be generous. That you can't solve everything. I mean, you're not God. You can't fix every situation in every corner of the world. But here's my challenge for you. That you would pick some things to get behind. And you would do for one what you wish you could do for all. That you would be generous to one the way that you wish you could be for all. Here's why this matters. And first of all, it matters to ourselves, because when we are generous and we don't just withhold God's love and keep it for ourselves and we let it just continue to pour through us, we're reminded of how truly generous God is in loving us. We're reminded of how truly generous God is in choosing us and sending his son to die for us. We are reminded of God's generosity when we're generous. But then secondly, when we're generous and we share about generosity, You can much more easily talk with someone who doesn't believe about an organization that you're involved in or the way that you volunteer or the way that you serve a lot more than you can talk about like the Ten Commandments or something. And you could much more easily talk about the things that you're involved with, the ways that you're generous and you are with the tenets of our faith. So first of all, being generous reminds us of God's grace for ourselves. And secondly, when we find ways that we can share about our generosity, not to brag about ourselves, but when we find ways that we can share, we tell people what God is like. We can tell people what God is like without telling them what God is like. And we can be generous without saying like, well, here's all the reasons why I do this. We can just say, here's this cause that I'm involved in. Would you like to be involved? And that is what makes us irresistible, I believe. And that is what makes us as a movement able to connect with the B's and C's, the people who maybe are indifferent to faith or people who are hostile to it. And they may never come to church with you. They may never develop a faith in Jesus Christ, but at least they can say, you know, I'm not sure that I believe what he does. I'm not sure I believe the same way that she does, but I can't deny how generous she is. I can't deny the love that she shows. I can't deny the way that she serves our community. I can't deny the way that he cares. So my hope and prayer for you is that you would learn to do for one what you wish you could do for all. That you show the kind of generous love to one person or one cause. That you're involved in our church here, that you give generously to our church, that you give generously of your time and your resources. Because we want to carry out God's kingdom. We want to further God's kingdom in our world. My prayer is that you would adopt this principle, that you would do for one what you wish you could do for all. Because I know that Christian generosity touches the world. Just a few people giving some meals to some prisoners thousands of years ago is a story that we still tell because of the effect that it had on people. And it had an effect for generations. It's the first principle of learning to live good, to live with good wealth, is to be generous, to be willing to give, because that might just change the world. Let's pray together. God, I pray that we would truly be generous people and that you would multiply our generosity in the hearts of our neighbors and our coworkers and our friends, that they would have questions in their hearts about why we do the things we do, that they would learn what God is like, even without us having to tell them that we're Christians, that we would just be generous. God, generosity changes the world. Your generous love for us has changed our worlds completely. And I pray that we will show that generosity to others. God, help us to do for one what we wish we could do for all. In your son's name I pray. Amen. Let's stand and worship together.